This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. In 1919, Albert Einstein's theory of relativity had captured the attention of scientists. Some astronomers wanted to test the theory by observing stars during a total eclipse. The result was an expedition from London to Brazil, and planning meant figuring out how to haul large equipment halfway across the world. Dan Kenefick, Associate Professor of Physics at the University of Arkansas, has just written an account of the preparation and journey undertaken by astronomers like Arthur Stanley Eddington and Frank Watson Dyson, called No Shadow of a Doubt, the 1919 Eclipse that Confirmed Einstein's Theory of Relativity. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to Kenefick last week and asked him how the eclipse could be used to prove Einstein's theory.
Because Einstein's theory of relativity, as you may know, deals with what would happen if we were looking at the universe while we were moving very, very quickly, or in the case of his theory of general relativity, in a very intense gravitational field. Nowadays, of course, we would immediately start talking about black holes and things like that. Well, of course, we don't live in a black hole and we're not moving all that rapidly. So it's not easy to test this theory experimentally. And that was a major challenge in the decades immediately after Einstein published his theory. So he was aware of this issue, and he decided himself, well, I'm going to have to help people out here. I'm going to have to identify ways that we might test the theory. One of them was his insight that light ought to be affected by gravity. At that time, in the 19th century, certainly, people regarded light as this wave propagating through space. It wasn't a material thing, so why would it be affected by gravity? Well, Einstein, as you know, came up with this very famous equation, E equal mc squared. He says, if something has energy, it has mass, according to my equation. We know light has energy, therefore I contend it ought to have mass. If it's affected by gravity, then if I look at a star close to the sun, as the light comes towards me, it'll pass very near the sun, and it should fall towards the sun, and that will deflect it, and that will change the apparent position of the star. So he tells astronomers, in starting in 1911 and 12 and 13, you ought to look at stars close to the sun and see if they're in a slightly shifted position. Well, of course, as he himself knew, and as the astronomers quickly informed him, we can't see stars close to the sun because the sun is too bright. And so they all agreed, well, I guess we're going to have to look at it during an eclipse. That's the only time. We're very fortunate on this planet of ours that our moon is just the right size, that it occasionally blots the sun out completely. And then we can see this area of sky quite close to the sun. And the idea was, we'll check if the stars are shifted ever so slightly. It's a very fine measurement, very difficult thing to do. And so that was the prediction that he made. And of course, it not only took him years to finish the theory, even after he'd had that fundamental insight, but it took even more years than that for astronomers to get on board, get the message, and figure out what they were going to do and make their plans. And they identified, in particular Dyson, who I just mentioned, identified 1919 as the perfect year for this test. Because, of course, it's one thing to have an eclipse, but you'd like to have some bright stars near the sun during that eclipse. And it so happens that that eclipse was the perfect timing. The sun would be in the star field of the Hyades, which is the closest star cluster to Earth. So a number of stars would be right near the sun. And he realized, even though a war was, you know, he realized this in 1917, the First World War was going on, and he knew it was going to be very difficult to get there, and probably impossible if the war didn't end in time. But he said, you know, still, we ought to try because we're not going to get a better opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, so you've got the Great War going on. I am unfamiliar with the equipment you would need in 1919 to do these measurements, but I'm guessing it didn't fit in a pocket.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So you've got to get this. And the other thing about total eclipses is they just don't happen anywhere.
That's right, exactly.
So what did it take?
It took a lot of planning, yes. Now, he was fortunate because in Britain, they were accustomed to going on these eclipse expeditions, usually for other reasons, right? This was the first time they were going to test Einstein's theory. But they had what was called a Joint Permanent Eclipse Committee, which was set up by two of England's most famous learned societies, the Royal Society of London — there's no more famous learned society — and the Royal Astronomical Society. And they had decided, we'll work together. So they already, for a couple of decades, had been working in this way. And Dyson was the chairman of this committee. That's why I say he was basically in charge. And he said to Eddington, you know more about Einstein's theory than anyone, and you're also an astronomer, so you need to come on board and help me out here. And they identified this eclipse as being perfect for its position in the sky, but unfortunately, the position and the timing on the Earth were less than optimal. The eclipse was due to cross the tropical regions near the equator South America and Africa. Much of it would be in mid-Atlantic. That's not much good. Much of it would be over the world's two great jungle basins, the Amazon and the Congo. Not good either, which are heavy astronomical equipment. So in looking for sites, they eventually selected a city in northeastern Brazil called Sobral because it was on the train line from a port they could get there, and an island called Principe off the coast of West Africa. And there weren't many other places. They really were limited in what they could do. And then they were very limited in how they could get there because shipping was suspended during the war. All those ocean liners that would normally sail to Brazil were engaged in war duties. And they really would have been unable to go if the war hadn't ended when it did in November 1918. You can see from their own notes and recollections that they were more or less giving up when the war suddenly ended. A colleague in Brazil tells me that the ship that they went on to Brazil was actually the first passage by an ocean liner after the war. So really, it ended just in time. And then, as if they didn't have enough troubles, the war ended, the big war ended, but a civil war broke out in Portugal in January 1919. So when Eddington set off, he went on the big ship to Brazil, but he got off on the island of Madeira, and he had no idea when he got off on that island how he was going to get from there to Principe because all the shipping in Portugal had been suspended for the Civil War. But luckily, that war turned out to be a very short duration, and after waiting for a month on the island, he finally found a ship to take him on. So one of the remarkable things that I learned as I was researching was that when Eddington started his voyage, he really had no particular idea how he was going to get there.
Wow. And of course, you dock, then you've got to get to the spot.
That's right, yes. And luckily, the people in Principe and in Brazil were very anxious to be of help. The Brazilian government waived customs duties for those big crates full of equipment. People in Brazil, I was there recently, there's a lot of excitement because this is the centenary, and some of them even said to me, you know, customs must have been a big problem. How did they get through customs so quickly? And well, it turns out that they had written to the Brazilians and they had arranged for the government to waive inspections. Local people pitched in and helped them select sites. Often there were difficulties. The area of Brazil they were in was going through a severe drought, but luckily the locals knew where there was one well that they could be beside. So they got a lot of help once they reached their locations.
Now, Einstein's theory had sent, you know, I don't know if the right word is shockwaves, but it had really shaken things up among astronomers and scientific community. Any way to know how much in the popular sphere it was?
I think until the eclipse announcement, most people weren't aware of it. Of course, it was all very new. The final version of the theory was only completed in late 1915, so only a few years before. And of course, you have to remember that was right during the war. So even scientists outside of Germany couldn't immediately read his paper because communication with Germany was cut off for those in Allied countries. So Eddington had to write to a colleague in neutral Holland to find out what Einstein's theory was all about.
Wow.
So it really wasn't that widely known. Of course, physicists and astronomers knew something about it. And we do know that Eddington was very excited about the theory. He thought, this looks really interesting. There's every chance that it's right. We really should test it. But we must remember that most astronomers were very skeptical. They were used to theorists coming up with ideas to challenge Newton's great theory of gravity. And in the past, that had always resulted in Newton's theory emerging triumphant when they did do the experimental test. So that's really what they expected. And that was one important thing that one reason why I mentioned earlier that I was a little skeptical about this talk about Eddington's bias. I knew that Eddington was quite hopeful that Einstein's theory would turn out to be correct, but every other astronomer that I knew of, and I had looked at some of the correspondence from the period, was very, very skeptical. And sure enough, both Eddington and Dyson in their letters agree that Dyson himself was quite skeptical to begin with. And as I said, he was the one who ended up making the key decisions. So I don't think it's quite fair to say that Einstein's theory had sort of seized the scientific imagination. There were one or two people who were excited about it. Most of the others thought, well, this is another newfangled
idea.
Here
we go again.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it something that could be measured, the stars during the total eclipse, immediately, or was there a period of time where you had to do some calculations?
Absolutely a period of time in which you had to do calculations. One of the most important figures on the expeditions was a man called Charles Davidson. Dyson himself couldn't actually go because of basically important things that he had to be doing at home. And Davidson was his man on the spot. Now, Davidson's original job title at the Greenwich Observatory was computer. In those days.
Because he was computing.
He was computing. But in those days, you didn't have an electronic computer. You had a human computer, often a woman. But the Greenwich Observatory paid well enough that they had male computers. Davidson was not only the computer, but he was also the telescope expert, the instrumentational expert. But he and another computer were the ones who did the laborious calculations, which you can see in their notes. Of course, Dyson was working with them, but they were the ones who were doing most of the pen on paper. And that took some time. Eddington was the one who was most excited. He was kind of hopeful that they would get the results out quickly. But, of course, as you might expect, it turned out that it wasn't that easy. And I think Dyson always knew, I don't think it's going to be that quick. There was a lot to do. They had to take pictures of the star field during the eclipse, of course. That was the point of going there. But then they also needed to take pictures of the same stars at night some months before or after, when the sun was no longer in the way, because those were the comparison plates. You had to carefully measure the differences in positions of the two stars. Keep in mind that the shift in position on the plates, it was so tiny that the size of the little blob of emulsion representing the star on the plate was actually bigger than the shift in position. Mm. So they were just looking like at a shift in position from the center of one star to the center of the same star on a slightly different plate. And then they had to do some careful calculations because, of course, the other reason that the star might change position is if the magnification of your telescope changed ever so slightly between those two times, that would, of course, shift the positions too. So they essentially had to calculate for that. And that was the really long and laborious part.
Looking through the papers, was there ever a eureka moment where they said, oh, we've got it? Or did it just slowly kind of add up?
I think it was a little bit of both. Obviously, they had to live with the data for weeks while they worked through it. And they did have some contradictory things to contend with. There were two telescopes used in Brazil. One of those got a result which agreed more with the old Newtonian theory. One of those got a result which agreed more with Einstein's theory. And this, of course, is the reason for this dispute today, right? Were they right to conclude that the telescope that agreed with Einstein was more dependable than the one that agreed with Newton? That's the decision that they had to make. And you can see the spot in their notes where they made that decision. And it's very clear cut. They actually state, they make a very complete, fully worded statement. Often in notes you're a little quick, but here they took their time and they said, well, for these reasons, this is the result of our expedition. And in fact, that quote even made it into the paper written in the notes. And so we can see the calculations that preceded it. We can see that eureka moment when they made the decision. It's worth pointing out that the writing is Dyson's, right? So it's Dyson's handwriting, not Eddington's. And it's also worth pointing out that we can sort of see very clearly why they made the decision, because actually the calculation that preceded that was not a calculation about the good instrument. It was actually a calculation about the bad instrument, and it was clear that they were convincing themselves, yeah, this instrument didn't really perform the way it was supposed to. And that happens all the time in science. Normally, what do? If the instrument didn't perform well, you do the experiment again. But, of course, with the eclipse, you can't, right? So all they could say was, well, okay, then we're not going to take that data. We'll use this other data instead.
Where was Albert Einstein during the eclipse?
Yeah, that's a great question. He was having quite an eventful year. This, of course, is the centenary year right now at the end of April. Both teams were on site at their locations in Brazil and Principe getting their equipment into place. Earlier in the year, in February, Valentine's Day, in fact, they had their last planning meeting before they set off on the trip. That very day, Einstein was in Zurich, Switzerland, getting divorced. He was in the divorce court, getting divorced from his first wife. He had just had a rough few years. His health was poor. His wife, he had been separated for some time. He had to go through this divorce to get to Switzerland to be in the divorce court. He had to more or less escape from Berlin, which was in revolutionary turmoil. The precursors of the Nazis were killing people in the streets. It was a rough start to the year. As the year went on, he knew that the British expeditions were in train, but he had no idea what was going on. People, as he said in his letters, kept asking him, what's the news? And he would say, well, I don't know, because he wasn't in touch with them. Finally, in September, Eddington gave a sort of a preliminary announcement, And the news was immediately passed on to Einstein through his Dutch friends. The Dutch were kind of the intermediaries. Even at this stage, the war was technically over, but there was still not much communication between the former enemies. And he quickly passed the news on to his mother and made an announcement in the German press. And then in November came the final announcement. Wow. And all of a sudden, Einstein, who was in Berlin at home, found himself a celebrity overnight. It was a staggering change of fortune from the previous difficulties he'd had for the previous few years to suddenly being the talk of the world. He didn't quite appreciate that part of it. He complained. He said, that eclipse expedition ruined my life, basically, because everybody wants to talk to me now. But at the same time, he was as excited as anybody else by the vindication of his ideas.
Dan Kenefick is an associate professor of physics at the University of Arkansas and author of No Shadow of a Doubt, the 1919 eclipse that confirmed Einstein's theory of relativity. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week.